Okay, well, greetings and welcome to the September 2024 edition of the DMSE Masterclass. This monthly session is designed for current DMSE students and faculty members, and frankly, anyone interested in the Doctor of Medical Science program here at the Arizona School of Health Sciences, A.T. Still University. Today, we have the privilege of hearing from remarkable masters in the PA profession and healthcare who have greatly influenced our field. So, but before we dive in, I have a few reminders for our participants. Please ensure your microphones are muted. You're encouraged to share comments or questions in the chat during the presentation. We'll have a Q&A segment right after, and we'll be monitoring the chat for any queries or any feedback that you have. So, it's certainly an honor today to introduce our guest speaker, PA John Burns. He boasts an impressive career in the PA field. John graduated from the University of Florida PA program in 1979 and has spent the past 44 years as a surgical PA in Orlando, Florida, initially focusing on cardiovascular and thoracic surgery. For the past 13 years, John went on to establish one of the first PA-owned surgical assisting practices in the nation in 1992, which he managed up until May of this year when his group was acquired by AdventHealth, Florida's largest healthcare system. Throughout his career, John has passionately advocated for reimbursement advances for PAs in surgery and beyond, collaborating with CMS, state and national legislators, and private insurers. John's dedicated service to the PA profession extends to the AAPA, where he participated in several councils and committees, as well as to the PA Foundation, where he served as board member and president. He also held the presidency of the Florida Academy of PAs and received their Lifetime Achievement Award. In 1982, John co-founded the Association of Physician Assistants in Cardiothoracic Surgery, earning the distinction of honorary fellow. In 2020, John was appointed by the Florida Surgeon General to chair the Council on PAs within the Florida Board of Medicine. He is also involved in various leadership committees at local hospitals, including those focused on credentialing and campus administration. Beyond his clinical and academic roles, John became an associate clinical professor at the FSU College of Medicine PA program in 2018 and is now the associate clinical education director for the Orlando campus. John has a long-standing commitment to charitable work and medical missions, having traveled widely, especially through Eastern Europe, on behalf of the U.S. State Department. As the Grand Prior of the Military and Hospitaller Order of St. Lazarus of Jerusalem, an ancient order dating back to the Crusades, John has worked in leprosy centers in India and Mexico, and most recently participated in medical missions in war-torn Ukraine. Today, John continues to lead his surgical PA group within AdventHealth and is focused on expanding this new service line. In his spare time, he tells me he enjoys traveling and spending time with his wife, Anna, who has accompanied him on many humanitarian endeavors. In fact, as I mentioned, he just returned from Ukraine. John, welcome to our master class.
Randy, it's a pleasure to be here. Thank you for the invitation. I'm honored that you asked me.
Absolutely. We were very excited about that. We're eager to hear about your journey in the PA profession, particularly your early experiences in PA school and in clinical practice, and your enduring involvement in cardiovascular surgery. Before we started recording, we were talking about some of the barriers of the early days of getting into especially practices of PA. Can you start off telling us a little about, what got you into PA school in some of those early years?
Well, I applied in 77, and at that time, Florida had one PA program compared to 18 now, and it's 52 in the country compared to 300 and growing. But I did not know what a PA was. I wanted to go to medical school, like I think most of us did at that time. And unfortunately, the demographics didn't work for me. So I went to the University of Florida to do a year of grad school, same time as an operating room technician during college and at the UF. So I knew I loved surgery. I just knew I needed to get into surgery sometime, somehow. My mother said, "You got 1 year to get this right." we're not going to pay any more tuition. So you got to figure out what you're going to do after this 1 year. You don't get a med school. So I heard about this PA thing. So I went down on campus and I applied and I got in. And I've never looked back. So it's been, I knew I wanted surgery, University of Florida. I think now at the my F, I look at FSU and all the assignments and EORs and the papers and all those things they had to do. We had enough. We had 12, 10, 4 week rotations. We had no EORs. We had no papers. We had nothing. We just did clinical work, but it really was good. So I knew it was surgery. And so cardiac surgery was my first job offer in Orlando. And the hospital didn't quite know what to do with me because I was the first PA and the first surgical PA. And, you know, if those of you that know cardiac surgeons realize they respect no rules. And so they had me doing all kinds of things that I knew how to do, but the hospital had no clue that I knew how to do that. So for 2 years, I was under the radar. And then finally, they said, who's this guy going around taking out veins and closing chests and making rounds and things like that? How does he know how to do that stuff? And so we need to make up rules. So that was the beginning of privileging. The good thing is they had our group write the privileges. So we still got our way. And so I enjoyed that because we're delegated a lot of different things. We made the rules for privileging as we went along. Reimbursement wasn't a big thing. That wasn't even on the radar because it's all about how could we make the patient experience better? How could we make the surgeon's time better? And how could we learn quicker? But then, you know, cardiac surgeon politics got in the way. And at that time, I decided to go off on my own. But before that, the only CME we could get was the AAPA. And at that time, it was all family medicine, which is what the PA profession was designed to do. But it didn't help those of us that were beginning in cardiac surgery or orthopedics or anything else to do that. So in 82, one of my partners and I formed the APACVS. Had our first meeting in Phoenix. We had 70 members. And now I think they're close to 1,000. And they have a PA as the CEO. And I'm very proud of the organization over the years. But in 92, I decided to go off and do my own surgical assisting thing. So for 2.5 years, 24/7 me. And then we got some more people. But then I realized there's a business of medicine. It's not just the practice of medicine. And as PAs at that time, and even today, we're kind of sheltered, I think, on the business of medicine. So you can work, but you got to get paid. And how are you going to get paid if no one recognizes you as a provider? And who's going to do your billing? And all those things that we now know, but I think we'll talk a little bit later, are still a roadblock for many. At that time, CMS, HCPA at that time, was not reimbursing for PA. Private carriers had no clue who we were. So in order to get this done, we had to do a lot of roadblock. We had to do a lot of creative things. I learned who the roadblocks were. I tried to befriend them, and usually it worked. Create relationships with Blue Cross in Florida, which was the CMS administrator, third-party administrator. Work with workers' comp. Work with our lobbyists for Florida Academy of PAs. And little by little by little by little, we chipped away at reimbursement. Otherwise, you couldn't do something like this. We had the regulatory side of the Board of Medicine to deal with. But I've always been someone, I hate the word someone. I like, if I say someone should do this and it's not me, that's to me, that's not appropriate because if you say someone, it's never going to get done. So I decided when I said they should, I want it to be the they. And one of my friends told me recently, why do you get involved? And I say, I may not be able to stop the train, but I want to hear it coming. And I think that's very important because if you wait on someone else, you may or may not get what you want. But over the years, the group flourished. We were able to change a lot of legislation in Florida. I think nationally, a lot of things followed. A lot of groups developed after our group did in Florida and other states. A lot of it depended upon state legislation for PAs, which is very archaic, way back when. Some states didn't even have any legislation. It was a wild, wild west. And slowly, in some places, it came about too much and it became too tight. And now there's a loosening going on, which is appropriate. Reimbursement, I think now, is the best it's ever been. It's not optimal. But at least now PAs can do a lot of things they couldn't do before. Again, the business of medicine is essential. So, you know, I credit my cardiac surgeons with giving me the skill to go out and do things. I credit them for with giving me the desire to leave them and to go off on my own. And I love the business of medicine. Michael Poe and I have worked for decades on a variety of things in the academy, and I'm proud of that work. He just retired. Lucky him, I'm still working. I guess he just had a better than I did. But for the most part, I hope it kind of sums up why I did what I did.
Yeah, that's wonderful. And you know, John, with so many years that you've been in surgery, and you were just saying that you really enjoy the business part. But in terms of the clinical part, what do you enjoy being, you know, a surgical PA, especially as assisting? I mean, what, you know, I've assisted a few times in my career. That's a lot of hours standing and doing things. So what did you like the best about that?
I like getting my hands dirty, and I like procedures. And I've always been one. I've always enjoyed technology, and tech. And when I first started in surgery, there was very little technology, and now there's a lot. And when I first started this company, we could assist on everything, and now you can't because of robotic surgery, robotic and IO, O-arms and spines. Neurosurgical navigation, even orthopedic robotics. So it's very, very difficult now to be able to be the jack of all trades. But I've always enjoyed technical procedures. I've enjoyed learning how to be adept with my hands. You know, we've all made mistakes. That's why it's called the practice of medicine. You know, my surgeons were always patient with me. And when we train people, we try to do the same thing because, again, you get better. When someone says, "I got it," you got to watch out because I still don't say I got it.
That's great. Well, you know, John, you've received numerous awards and accolades over the years, showcasing your outstanding contributions to the profession, your significant engagement with organizations like the Florida Academy and the PAs in cardiovascular medicine, and also the PA Foundation. Certainly have been noteworthy. What inspired you to get involved with these organizations? And could you provide some insights on that?
A lot of it was necessity. So early on, as I mentioned, we had problems with reimbursement. So if you're not going to work for somebody where your income is not your how you make your income is not important, it's not that big of a deal. But in our situation, we were a business. We had to have schedulers. We had to pay malpractice. We had to pay dues. We had to pay all of our expenses, our CME, and that kind of thing. We had to generate revenue, and revenue was out there. So again, these are the days before managed care. HCBA and CMS were slowly coming around. Reimbursement was very good if you were able to get it. But I got involved in FAPA because that's where it starts. The state legislation is where a lot of things started. There was bills going through for reimbursement, and our lobbyist at the time, John Mixon, who was wonderful, and now his daughter, Corinne Mixon, is our lobbyist. She works in a management company. Were able to get us integrated in a lot of bills that, for one, mandated reimbursement of a PA provided assisting in lieu of a physician, purposely keeping out percentages because we don't want to get hogtied into that. So that was very, very important. And then being able to create, at that time, we had supervision requirements, which are now been eliminated, which is great, but make them palatable. On the federal side, working with Michael Poe and the Academy, trying to get CMS way back when it was 65% in surgery to assist. And you had to fight to get that. You had to find a way to, we had to have our surgeons bill for us, and then we had to invoice them, and we had to hope they would pay us. So it was a very multi-tiered process. And then eventually CMS went to 85% in all practice settings. The Infinite II came along, which really didn't affect us. And now we're 85% of what we're doing, and we still need things like direct reimbursement from CMS to make things on a par. But we were able to generate a business plan when we were able to generate reimbursement streams. But you need to have lawyers, you need to set up an LLC or a company, you needed billing because all of us are providers. I'm not smart enough to be a biller, and billing is a profession because you can do all the cases or see all the patients you want. But if your biller goes home at five and leaves a bunch of appeals on the desk, you're stuck. So we have to, and that we learn the hard way that billing is just as important as what you do every day at the hospital in the office.
Yeah, it's so important. Tell us a little bit about your work with the PA Foundation, both as a board member and a past president.
I got involved initially with the Surgical Council of the AAPA and going to AAPA meetings, and that was before we had any specialty groups. And that's when the AAPA was still not very supportive of surgical PAs at all. And it was, and Randy, you were up there at some of those meetings when we were having knockdown, drag-off fights in House of Delegates about that. But slowly, got into it, and we got some progress. But even when I was in college, I did some charitable things at home, going to, we did some free healthcare clinics. And when I was in Rollins College, undergrad, I went to Thailand and spent 6 weeks over there in refugee camps. And I guess I liked the intrigue and the travel. And it was a double bonus because I got to enjoy what I like to do and also give back something. So to me, it was a perfect combination. The PA Foundation at that point had some very interesting people in there. I kind of gravitated towards that, not really understanding what it did. But after I learned about it and developed relationships with their directors, and I think every PA leader has been through the foundation in one way, shape, or form over the years. It was a fun organization doing good things, and we had good times at the AAPA meetings. We provided scholarships. We provided grants. We did a lot of good things. And when I became president, it was great because then we were developing a very tight bond between the PAF, AAPA, it was APAP at that point. And I think it was not the ARC, but CAHAP, who was the preceding one. And we worked very closely together. And that was a great way to do things. And I had met some lifelong friends because of that. But PA Foundation started me on my quest to continue to do more.
Excellent. Well, let's sort of change to a different topic and talk a little bit about some of the professional issues going on in the profession as we're now way past our 50-year mark, in fact, heading for our 60-year mark. And given your extensive experience, what are your thoughts on the current challenges facing the PA profession, in particular the optimal team practice? That was passed, I think, a number of years ago, and now each state is working on their legislature to, to get certain elements of optimum team practice. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, things like OTP, the name change, compact are all tied together. And a lot of right now we seem to be going through a period of competitive jealousy or competitive concern with different professions. AMA is certainly one of them. The nurse practitioner organization, the OTP, I think on the you look at it as a global thing, it's good because it provides for scope of practice, and it provides for, it doesn't show you, it doesn't provide the game plan. It just kind of provides a strategy that we need to do. And, one thing that, again, I go back to the business of medicine, but in OTP and optimal team kind of care approach really is only going to apply to non-proceduralists. It's going to be family medicine, internal medicine, things like that. But again, then we're going to go back to the business of medicine. So I know in Florida, they're looking at some autonomous legislation to mirror the nurse practitioners and family medicine with certain regulations. But I keep on suggesting that you need to be concerned with the business of medicine. So it's great for John Burns, PAs, and family medicine to hang out shingle outside in my office. But who's going to pay me? And how am I going to get a insurance contract? Right now in Central Florida, about 60% of all physicians work for, we have two really big systems and one smaller one. they work for those three systems, and they're getting very, very, very good contracts. Private providers aren't. So a private provider may be getting 80, 90% of Medicare, and a big system can generate 180, 200% of Medicare. And they can provide a whole lot more services. So John Burns, PA, hanging a shingle out, yes, I can see patients. Where am I going to get them? How am I going to market for them? How are they going to pay me? Who will take the patient, my complication? And it's things like that. I need to have staff. I got to hire an MA. I got to save a couple hundred thousand up front in order to do that. So again, skill for practice, I'm all for. I've worked very, very hard on these hospitals down here. Our skill for practice is optimal. There's nothing that we can't do that we're trained and allowed to do by legislation or by our trainings. I'm very happy with that. I think it's great if we could have autonomy, and we could, especially family medicine. But again, you need to be cognizant of the business part of medicine to do that. The name change, again, I don't like the word assistant. Associate would be certainly more palatable. My concern is legislation. And when you open up legislation, anybody can jump in. So again, that's one concern. The compact is something, I'm not sure if you're all familiar with that, but I know we've been pushing that. And I was a proponent in my position as a CAPA member and on the Board of Medicine PA Council until something came to my attention about 6 weeks ago. And I have a call tomorrow with the Board of Medicine. And that is that there's a loophole. So, you know, for those of you that aren't sure about the compact, it's basically reciprocity. If you have a license in one state and that state belongs to the compact, you can go from state to state. To me, that's perfect for locum PA. You don't need to wait for your license to be approved. It's excellent. But that says that the playing field is level. And we're all PACs, NCCPA certified, licensed, ARCPA graduates. But we have found out since we're in Florida, we've had this issue before in the 1990s with foreign medical graduates trying to become PAs. It's become an issue again. And so in Puerto Rico, which has a very, very underserved population, they had 16,000 providers about 5 years ago. They're down to about 8,000. An unlicensed medical graduate, having never worked, can get a license as a PA. And to get an MPI taxonomy code as a PA. Arizona will accept that and give them a full and active license. Arizona, I believe, is part of the compact. Is that correct, Randy?
I think they're working on it right now, but they're close to being part of the compact. But your point is well taken, yeah.
Which means every state that belongs to the compact has the possibility of one of these PAs never becoming a PAC, never being trained as a PA, with no knowledge of why they didn't become a medical graduate, becoming a PA in that state. Now, can they become a PAC? No. So in Florida, you must be a graduate of an ARCPA program, an NCCPA certified. But does that mean legislation can't be changed? No. So right now, we're dealing with two bills. One is telehealth, and one is temporary PA licensing, both of which can be loopholes where these individuals can come up. They may be well-trained, or they may not be, but they will be called physician assistants. And I think that's something that we need to be concerned about, because if Arizona is going to give them a license and 13 other states will, they're going to be out there. Can they get paid? Who knows? But they are marketing themselves as you and I.
Yeah, and you bring up a good point. What happened in Arizona was during COVID, when the governor decided to have put through a loophole to allow foreign medical grads or particularly in Puerto Rico, PAs over there who have not gone through an ARCPA training program. And currently in Arizona, there are 250 of those folks who have now come into the state. And some of them are using PA-C, and the NCCPA is looking into that. But you're right. So 250, and there may be more, is certainly, and these are people who have not graduated from an ARC-PA program, but they have all the rights and privileges of every other PA in Arizona. So you bring up a really important point.
Well, in Florida, we have areas of critical need that are defined by the Florida Surgeon General. And you can get a temporary PA license that never expires, renewed annually, if you are one of these individuals. You can only work in certain ACN areas, but that can be expanded if the Surgeon General's decision to do that. But they're still calling themselves PA. And the public has no difference if John Burns PA sees them in surgery and then another PA sees them who's not a PA. It could be a problem for our profession. Telehealth, our license are going to be people who are similar, who are out of state. And again, all you need to do is have the taxonomy code, and they can provide telehealth anywhere in Florida. So it's a problem.
Yep, certainly more things that the profession has to deal with. Let me move on to another topic that's we've had sort of an ongoing debate regarding the entry level doctoral degree in PA education. I know as a faculty member, you've heard of that. I'm not talking about the post professional doctoral program, but moving the entry level programs to a doctorate level. And as you know, PAEA has had a summit. Two different summits over the last 3 or 4 years, and has continued to be a proponent of master's level training. So what are your thoughts on entry level doctoral degree for PAs? And what would your advice be, you know, let's stop at that. You know, what do you think about the entry level doctorate discussion?
Well, I'm probably the least degreed person on the screen right now, because when I finished, I had two bachelors. That's all I have. That's all that was offered. But because I'm grandfathered in, it doesn't matter anymore. Because it was way back when. I think the master's, the elevation to master's was good. I think, I'm not sure it does that much more clinically for that PA. It doesn't change anything financially, comp-wise. But I think we did that, in my opinion, we did that because the nurse practitioners were doing that. And I think it does land another level of education and professionalism to our profession when you're a master's trained PA. So I have no issue with that. But, you know, and I couch my words because I'm talking to a doctoral program right now. But I think it's great if you want to get into academics, because I think without that, you're not going to have an opportunity. It makes a difference in compensation in academics. But clinically, again, it's not. I don't think it's going to provide, at least right now, doesn't provide any additional opportunities in a pure clinical setting. You cannot call yourself a doctor, at least in Florida, and just as a DNP cannot call him or herself a doctor in Florida. I know other states are challenging that, but you call yourself what your degree, what your license as, which is a PA or nurse practitioner, so John or whomever, to do that. I have no qualms. Most of my colleagues at FSU have it or are getting it. If I wasn't so old, I'd probably do the same thing, just because it'd be a good things to learn. But it's not going to help me. My concern is that it's going to raise tuition at programs, and I think PAEA is, you know, sort of has a thought about that, because it's going to bring more money into that. They're going to price out some people from becoming PAs, because now it's doctoral level education versus master's, or it may. You don't know. As far as, you know, since nurse practitioners have stated that the DNP is their end game, if you are not a DNP, so again, at the program I'm affiliated with, all preceptors are given a faculty appointment. So PAs with a master's become an associate professor. NP to the master becomes a faculty one and faculty two. They can never become a professor rank because their end game is a DNP. Until they achieve that, they'll never be at the same level. So it's a double-edged sword.
Yeah, well said. Well, let's move on to some of your volunteer work, and I know you just got back from Ukraine a couple of weeks ago. Would you tell us a little bit about your commitment to, you know, working internationally, in particularly with Ukraine? You and I had a wonderful talk when I saw you in Florida last month about this very thing. So tell us about your commitment to that, and maybe share some of your experiences in Ukraine.
Well, when I was in the Foundation Board, the State Department and AAFP had these annual trips to mainly Eastern Europe at that point. And I became friends with some of the people, maybe you think Sandy Panther from AAFP and some of the members of the State Department and our corporate members of our board. And so that's where I got my bug to go to. I was born in Japan. My dad was in the Air Force, moved all around the world. I love traveling. So if you say, you want to go to Botswana tomorrow? I'm packing and I'm going. So I have no issue with that. So when they said, do you want to go to Kyrgyzstan or Tajikistan or to Georgia or Moldova or Ukraine? Sure. So every fall we go there and we would meet with the embassy people and we would do teaching and training. I learned a lot about different cultures and it was great. But I learned a lot about Eastern Europe. I learned some Russian language. I just learned to enjoy that part of charitable trips. I met my wife actually in Ukraine on a medical trip about 20 years ago. And we got married in Ukraine, in Kyiv actually. And so I've been back, you know, 25, 35 times since before the war started. So obviously when the war started, Ukraine was near and dear to my heart. But it's because of my participation in the Order of St. Lazarus, which I'm the head of the U.S. group, we do a lot of international charitable activities around the world, and we decided to fund some money to go to Ukraine. And since amputees are 50% of all the casualties because of the mines and the bombs, and the fact that there's no helicopters to fly to the OR, when we in Iraq, Afghanistan, and Vietnam, if you were injured, you're in a helicopter and you're on a table in an hour. So limbs, it'd be a 5% amputation rate. Now it's 50%. Because you can't get anywhere in less than 2 or 3 days. And then if you get somewhere, you're probably septic or ischemic. So last year we did a baby step trip and we found a military hospital in my wife's hometown that had a lot of amputees and they had prosthetics, but they didn't know how to use them. So we bought about 100,000 worth of things in Europe, drove from Germany, 15 hours to the border, spent a couple of days crossing, and they are now able to rehab these amputees so they can use their prosthetics. It was 250 beds, and it was wonderful. We drove back, and we had air raids every day. You get used to them, and because the people live, they don't worry about them, so I don't worry about it. You look ahead, you look front, you look behind. You don't hear anything. You just keep on going. So this year, one of our members is a former military reservist and intelligence, and they were having problems with the front lines and getting tourniquets. So those of you that have maybe been in procedures, these are combat tourniquets that you put on and you got to put them on so hard that it's painful. Ukraine has some interesting dynamics with fighters. And I will say that there's Ukrainian army and then there's the foreign international brigade. So we did things with both, but the bottom line is we bought 200 of these high-end combat tactical first aid kits, and we took them to our group of five, all former military. I was the odd man out, but I was the medical person. Went to the Zaporozhye region on the southern front, and went to this very hidden bunker, helmets in place, and showed them how to use this stuff, because you can provide anybody anything. But if they don't know how to put it on or turn it on, it's useless. They took it very seriously because one of the members of our group lost his leg in Ukraine 11 months ago. And so when he showed them his prosthetic, they took this training very seriously. And so we experienced all kinds of challenges along the way, but it was so rewarding to see soldiers from 20 to 70, grandfathers going out to fight, who have grandsons who have been killed, because this is their country. So I'll do it again. And I'll continue to do it because this is something from the heart, but it was just well worth it.
Wow. What would you say to some of our students and our graduates or our faculty who are perhaps interested in getting involved in going over to Ukraine or some other international places? How would they get involved?
I would pick a less risky spot for your first trip. There are a lot of, we start off every year here in Orlando. I put together, we have 3 theater programs, and we work with some groups providing physical for disadvantaged, economically disadvantaged kids. So 2 weekends in the summer, we get all our students together from 3 programs, and we do about 1,000 exams on one Saturday. The students get to know each other. They get it's a, it's a they can great practice. The students receiving the physical love it. We refer them if we need to, and they love it. So I get them indoctrinated at this level. Hospitals have mission trips. Advent has mission trips all over the Caribbean. I would and if you there are a lot of things, a lot of groups online. I would just make sure you're comfortable with international travel, and make sure you're prepared. Make sure you're going to be you're a participant. You don't want to go and be a medical tourist. You want to be able to provide a service. So even if you're just a PA in family medicine or you're starting out in surgery, you still have the ability to help. So look around, start off small, look around your own hospital, look around your own specialty groups, see what they have. It is so rewarding to go. And I just can't stress that enough.
Excellent. Well, I'm going to sort of land this airplane in just a minute and ask for folks to if they have any questions. But John, with all the things that you do, and my guess is I know the answer to this. I want to ask you what you do for fun, and it sounds like everything that you do is for fun. But what else do you do out there that really is exciting for you to do?
My biggest hobby was scuba diving. And I haven't the last 3 or 4 years. Oh, I see Beth must be a diver. She has class in hand. I love underwater photography. And that to me, I like focusing on things. So I had opportunities for many years to travel all around the world, mainly in the Pacific, because I love military history and naval history. And I love shipwrecks. So I've been all around the Pacific to a lot of the big naval battles. And I love it because then we spend a week or so going to the islands and visiting with the natives. My house is like a museum. I have so much native stuff, but I love it. I just love meeting. I love meeting people. I love new adventures. I love eating different things. I don't mind camping out with mosquitoes. I like that part. I also like the four seasons. So don't get me wrong about, I need to be in out there, but and then traveling. We just like traveling and seeing different things.
Wow, that's wonderful. Well, let me open it up. We've talked about a lot of things in the last 40 minutes or so, from your early days as a PA and surgery, and also getting involved in the politics of the profession, and now the great work, the philanthropic work, the work that you do. Let me open up. Let's see. Well, Kendra Clark, who's on here, asked that, would Randy, would you ask about funding options for humanitarian work? So, yeah, any thoughts about that?
Oftentimes, you're funding yourself. You can certainly write that off. Some hospitals will fund you. I know at Advent here, they will fund a limited number of providers. There's also, they may provide or provide PDO for that, so you don't have to do that. Every group is different. It depends what you're providing. All my trips to Eastern Europe were on my own. To me, if I go back and say, if I had traveled less, could I retired sooner? Maybe. But to me, I enjoyed it, every minute of it. The people I met, lifelong friends. So funding is a challenge sometimes. I know some people I've talked to around the country, have had fundraisers to do that. It depends on what the cost is and what your circle of friends and family is and what the costs are going to be. It's oftentimes it's expensive to be charitable. And but again, where you're going is really appreciative. So there's no grant making process. It's just going to be if you, a group may have specific funding funders. Just depends upon where you may want to go.
Great, thank you. Who else has a question for John?
I have another question, Dr. Danielson. It's
Sure.
Kendra Clark here. Sorry, I'm in the store right now. I want to say, first of all, thank you so much for the humanitarian work and the leadership, and just your legacy. It's been so rewarding to hear this dialogue between the two of you. I think, and I'm so sorry, I don't recall your name, your PA Burns, correct?
It's John.
John, okay, great. So if you could just say, because you have such a robust just experience in the humanitarian service, is there something that, say, perhaps that most of us that do not have a lot of experience do not know in terms of what kind of services you can provide, what kind of services you typically provide? Is there a range of services that we might not be aware of? Just things like that, because I think that, at least for myself, I'm very interested in considering some trips down, in the future. And so, what areas are safest? I just feel like anything you can share that maybe those of us that don't have a lot of experience in humanitarian service, what we don't know what we don't know. So in other words, tell us what we don't know, in just a short amount of time, if you don't mind.
Sure. Most groups are focused on a particular mission. And it may be smiles, for example. Really do cleft palate repairs and things like that. It may be on hernias. It may be on maxillofacial. It may be on primary care, refugee centers. It's all about the group. So, again, I don't know where you currently work, or base, but I would first check with your local hospital systems. See, it's here in Orlando. Orlando Health and Advent Health have trips every several times a year, and a lot of them are primary care focused to the Caribbean or to Mexico. They do smile programs there, but every
Right.
hospital has different relationships. The Philippines is a big target, but it's usually it'd be unusual to have a multi-specialty trip. It's usually gonna you don't have to be in that specialty to help
Right.
out
Okay.
because you can be, I went to a refugee camp in Laos many, many, many years ago when I was in college.
Wow.
And
Wow.
I just did grunt things, but someone has to do grunt things. And I think it's just a matter of learning and being willing to jump in and get dirty. And then
Right.
you make networking. I'm a big fan of networking. When you know someone, they know someone and they know someone and they know about you, pretty soon you got the
Yeah.
dots connected.
I appreciate your feedback and insight. I might reach out to you in a few years. I know who to call now. Thanks,
Email me
John.
or call me anytime.
Thank you, Dr. Danielson.
Oh, you bet. And there's not only hospitals and programs, many of the organizations like Rotary and Lions Club do things. In fact, my wife has been involved over the years of taking glasses down to Mexico, and getting people glasses who need them. And it's amazing, just the simple thing of getting glasses for kids and adults who haven't been able to see for some time makes a huge difference. And so John's right. It depends on the organization. But once you get involved, it sort of pulls you in, pulls your heartstrings in. So great questions, Kendra. Thank you. Anybody else?
I just want to see his photography from scuba diving.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Those are the days. Those are the days that we didn't have much technology. This was before digital. Then I graduated to digital. That was great. So the only mistakes I made, I went from underwater wreck diving to shark diving, and those are probably some of the dumbest trips I've ever made. But I can at least I can I have all four limbs. I got some great pictures, so I survived. I would not necessarily advise doing something like that to get, but it was fun.
It's
Well, you'll have to talk. I don't know if you know Frank Crosby or not. Frank's one of our faculty members. He's retired Air Force, lives up in Colorado, but he and his wife are avid scuba divers, and they're always going somewhere. And I'm jealous because we're about the same age, and I can't even imagine doing that. But anyway, those are great questions. Thank you, guys. John, I'm going to give you sort of the last word. Any advice that you would give to our doctoral students, that these are all PAs from different walks of life, different specialties, who, like you had mentioned earlier, are interested in either going into academia or into leadership at organizations, or even finding ways to enhance their clinical practice, and or having that parity with our other colleagues out there, the NPs and the PTs and like that. What's your advice to our students as they graduate and move on?
I think the biggest thing is to get involved and stay involved. It doesn't really matter if academics or clinical work or charitable work or any work at all. If you're going to sit back, you're going to get run over. And I think if you get involved, you get involved appropriately, you look around, who are the people in charge? Who are the people who are obstacles? Who are the people you have to befriend? Be well informed. I find many of my own colleagues are arguing vehemently with that information, and it doesn't help. So just make sure you're well informed, get involved, and at least you'll have a say in what you want to do, and hopefully that'll help your colleagues. But I can't stress that enough. When you point the finger at somebody else, thumb goes back to you. So I always use that analogy. I think no matter what you do in life, so long as you do that, you stay informed, stay involved, you'll be fine no matter where you go.
Well, that's great advice. Thank you so much. And John, we really appreciated your time this last hour, and for participating in our master class. And for the rest of you and those that you will watch this later, please join us in October 14th for our next master class, who's actually going to be with Marilyn Fitzgerald. John, you remember Marilyn from the AAPA. Marilyn's a wonderful lady, a longtime PA advocate, and a longtime staff member with the AAPA, and has lots of great stories to tell. She first joined the AAPA in 19, I think it was 1977 or 78. But please join us for that master class. And for the rest of you, have a wonderful evening. Again, thank you for your time, and thank you for joining us today. And the best to all of you. Have a great night.
Thank you very much. Bye-bye.